8 months into the coronavirus pandemic with no signs of it slowing, medical professionals are feeling burned out.
We are fighting so hard right now to do the right thing so that we don't become infected, so that we don't infect others. And every little stressor is going to cause her or him to have that one little chink in the armor, so to speak.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, November 18th, a look at how doctors and nurses are dealing with the stress. Also, Oregon Governor Kate Brown puts the state on a two-week freeze to slow the spread of COVID cases, and she has a message for Washington.
I don't give a damn if you're Democrat or Republican. We need you to work together in Congress and deliver a second coronavirus relief package.
And what President-elect Biden's administration means for Ethiopia, Nigeria, and the broader African continent. But first, on Tuesday, close to 160,000 Americans were diagnosed with the coronavirus, a 79% increase from just 2 weeks ago. As COVID cases climb and hospitals around the country fill to capacity, nurses, doctors, and other healthcare professionals who are caring for these patients say they are burned out.
I am Elizabeth Riley, and I'm a registered nurse.
Elizabeth works in Cumberland, Wisconsin, where coronavirus cases have skyrocketed over the past few weeks. Back in the spring, she volunteered to go to New York City, where infections were surging there, and work in an intensive care unit. But now she's seeing troubling echoes of that earlier stage in the pandemic in her own hospital.
When we don't have staff because they're out sick or out quarantined, then we've got people who are picking up extra shifts, and we have people working long, long hours, many days in a row. And that was something I did when I was in New York, and I didn't make it my full 21 days just because I was so sick and so tired because I worked that many days in a row of 12-hour shifts. Now, we don't work 18 days straight of 12-hour shifts, but we will work a lot of extra hours, a lot of extra days. Everybody has banded together as a team, and I think you're going to see that in any organization, especially this one where I work. Within the last probably 8 weeks, we have seen a huge spike in COVID cases, and it has had a profound effect on what we want to do and what we can do, both in that there are high numbers of infected people in our communities, many of whom are winding up coming to our hospital. But we also have staff members who get infected with COVID, and then they can't work.
But even as Elizabeth and her colleagues have banded together, she struggles with the number of people in her community who continue choosing not to wear masks.
I don't want to say hurtful, because I think that people who decide not to wear masks are not necessarily trying to be hurtful. I think a lot of those people simply don't understand the truth of the situation, or choose not to believe the truth of the situation. And when that affects my coworkers in the way it has, I find it quite upsetting, because I believe I work with the best healthcare professionals in the country, in the world. I feel like they're sacrificing themselves to some degree for people who, for whatever reason, don't want to believe it's as big a problem as it is. It hurts my heart to see such really wonderful professionals having to put themselves on the line all the time, just trying to get through in the community without getting sick.
That's a feeling other medical professionals say they understand.
Hello, my name is Jean Ross, and I am president for National Nurses United. I live in Bloomington, Minnesota. It's a suburb of Minneapolis.
National Nurses United is the largest organization of registered nurses in the United States. And we spoke to Jean at the end of March as the pandemic was gaining steam and nurses and doctors in hospitals were scrambling to respond. Today, Jean says resource problems still exist, and there's a heavy burden on nurses to set clear boundaries in their COVID work.
We have to be able to speak up as professionals and say, no, I won't accept this assignment. There aren't enough of me to take care of that type of patient. No, I won't go into that room with what you're telling me is acceptable PPE when I know better. no, you cannot put that patient in with other non-COVID patients because they should be separated. That patient is showing signs of COVID or SARS-CoV-2. Those are the kinds of things nurses as professionals need to be able to do to represent their patients and themselves. It does take a huge toll on nurses to have to be doing that because we are fighting so hard right now to do the right thing so that we don't become infected, so that we don't infect others. And every little stressor that you put on a nurse at this point is going to cause her or him to have that one little chink in the armor, so to speak, that they're fighting, all that cortisol, all that stress. I listen daily now, semi-daily, to nurses being asked about burnout and how stressed they are, how anxious, how little sleep they're getting. And I think most of us nurses will tell you, it's okay. We know that for a period of time, it would be bad like this, but we really expected better. We expected some relief, some respite. Don't worry so much about our burnout if you do what we ask you to do. Then we will be just fine.
What they need, she says, includes broad public support in petitioning the Trump administration to gear up manufacturing for more personal protective equipment here in the United States.
You have trusted us year after year. We end up at the top of the poll for the country's most trusted profession. There's a reason you trust us. You can trust us now. Please, please listen.
Over in Chicago, hospitals have seen an influx of COVID patients for the past 2 weeks.
My name is Kalila Gates. I am a pulmonary and critical care specialist at Northwestern Medicine in Chicago. Back in March, April, there was that fear of the unknown. We didn't know what these patients would present. We didn't know exactly how to treat them. And now we have a much better understanding of how to treat them, but we are definitely exhausted. We have been doing this since March. COVID patients didn't go away. So this kind of idea that like now we're taking care of COVID patients, again, we never stopped taking care of them. So there's this level of exhaustion. There's this level of frustration in which we feared that we would be back here and we hoped that we could do things differently so that we didn't get back here. And it just, we weren't able to do that. So there's this fear of frustration on top of exhaustion. Frustration on top of exhaustion. Frustration on top of exhaustion.
Dr. Gates and her colleagues have found some ways to manage that exhaustion.
Now, more so than ever, this idea of wellness is very important and it's very much propagated. So what do we do to keep ourselves well? And so a lot of that is a personal determination, but a lot of it is things that we do in the ICU. After rounds, one day we had a stretching session where we were just able to all get up and with the nurses and stretch. Just talking with the nurses and sitting down and decompressing and just letting people know that, you know, we're in this together and we're going to make it through this as well.
Despite the burden the pandemic has placed on healthcare workers like Dr. Gates, she says she's not going anywhere.
I didn't sign up for this. I didn't choose critical care medicine knowing that there was a pandemic in the near future. But at the same time, this is kind of what we signed up for. And I think that's the approach that we take. And so, yes, it's challenging. And I would not be telling the truth if I sometimes didn't at least pause and say, you know, what am I doing? But at the same time, like, this is why I've chose this, is to be able to help people. This is why I'm in academic medicine, to be at the forefront of a new illness and, you know, be able to present information and data to help all of us get through. So yes, it's challenging. And at times you do question, like, what are you doing? But at no point did I ever truly say, you know, I don't want to do medicine anymore. Like, this is what I've trained for, and I'm able to do that. And I think many of us feel the same way.
In Columbus, Ohio, one doctor is facing many of the same questions about how to stay well while carrying out this critical work.
My name is Matthew Exline. I'm a physician at the Ohio State University Wexler Medical Center. I also serve as the medical director of the medical intensive care unit. We are in a distinct second peak at our hospital.
The Ohio State University Wexler Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio, was hit with an early wave of cases in the spring, which was driven back then by prison and nursing home outbreaks in the state of Ohio. Today, it's a different picture.
What we're seeing now is larger numbers of patients, and they're coming from everywhere. They're community members, community spread. There's not really a theme to who is getting admitted other than they tend to be older and with other underlying medical conditions. But in terms of where they're catching COVID, all different kinds of exposure. And the numbers were probably at least twice as high as we were in the early fall and probably three times as high as we were at kind of the low point in the early summer. I am in the short term very concerned. On the one hand, you spend all day working and planning on how you're going to manage these patients. And then all of the ways you would unwind when you get home have kind of been taken away. You know, sports are, you know, here at Ohio State, we weren't able to watch the Buckeye football game last weekend because of COVID. I can't go to the gym because of COVID. I can't take my family out to a restaurant because of COVID. And so it does feel like you can't escape the virus.
In a given week, he works with COVID patients managing symptoms at home, as well as the most critically ill COVID patients in the ICU.
There's the patients who are awake and breathing on their own, and we're using a lot of oxygen to support them. And then the other group of patients are those that are really sick and they end up on the ventilator. And then the frustration is obviously they're no longer, generally speaking, not awake enough to interact with us. And on the unfortunate cases where the patient's not doing better, it's a real struggle because, you know, when you normally have a patient who's dying in the ICU, we really want to make the family part of, you know, the care team and really want to let the family understand what's going on and let them be with their loved one as much as possible. And unfortunately, COVID doesn't let that happen. And so I know you've seen all the media reports and everything of families having to say goodbye over Facebook Live or Zoom calls, et cetera. But if you're on the ICU, if you're on the ventilator, you're not even awake enough and you can't have that connection of just like a loved one holding your hand at the end. And so that's a struggle. And I think that, you know, usually some of the catharsis for a healthcare worker is even if you can't help the patient, you feel like you can help the family deal with the grief. And so our nurses, our doctors, they don't even get that kind of feedback. And so I think that's a real struggle when we take care of these patients.
But Dr. Exeline says he keeps looking for ways to cultivate joy every day.
Just judging from my friends, I was inspired to put my Christmas lights up a lot earlier than I normally do, partly because the weather was nice, partly because I was going to have to work over Thanksgiving weekend, so I wasn't going to have time then, and partly just you want a little more joy in your life. And so with Christmas and the new year comes new hope that 2021 is going to be better.
Here's to that hope indeed. And we're very thankful for the medical professionals you just heard from. If you're in the medical profession, give us a call at 877-869-8253 about your experience with burnout. We'll keep listening. In Oregon, like so many states across the U.S., COVID hospitalizations are now at record levels. On Sunday alone, health officials reported more than 800 new cases of COVID-19. Just 2 days earlier, Oregon Governor Kate Brown announced new restrictions aimed at curbing the spread of the disease, harkening back to the early days of the pandemic. Starting today, there will be a two-week freeze in Oregon, limiting restaurants and bars to takeout only and closing gyms, museums, and other places of indoor and outdoor recreation. Already, the new restrictions are being met with backlash. Some business owners, especially in the restaurant industry, and some elected officials have criticized the decision, with some worried about what it will mean for their business's survival. So what do the new restrictions mean for the state? To answer that and more, we went right to the source.
My name is Kate Brown, Governor of Oregon.
Here's what Governor Brown told me about why the two-week freeze was necessary.
Hospitalizations are rising sharply in Oregon. And in fact, our metro area hospitals are being stretched to capacity, and some have voluntarily began to stop surgeries to preserve beds and staff capacity. These measures are necessary to give Oregon a fighting chance to stop COVID-19 cases.
Governor, are you also concerned about the potential shortages for medical personnel from other parts of the country, given that so much of the country is now battling COVID-19 much more than it was in the beginning of the pandemic?
Absolutely. My top priority as governor is to save lives and keep Oregonians healthy. We use science and data here to make decisions. But as you know, we're surrounded by hot spots from Idaho to Washington to California. Each one of us can make a difference. We're truly all in this together, and we all have to take action to keep ourselves healthy, our families healthy, and our communities healthy.
Governor, you mentioned the state of California and Washington. You also recently signed a new coronavirus travel advisory in conjunction with those two states and those two governors. What's the hope there?
Our hope is that we will send a very clear message to folks living on the West Coast. We want you to travel, but we want you to do it safely. And we ask you to quarantine for 2 weeks, both prior to your departure and upon your return. The virus obviously spreads very readily from person to person, and it's critically important that we protect our vulnerable populations, our elderly, our folks with underlying health conditions, and appreciate the willingness of my fellow governors on the West Coast to take immediate action.
There are also limits that you've put on private social gatherings, limiting those to 6 people. But Governor, with those private gathering limitations and the travel advisory restrictions, how are you expecting to enforce those, particularly as we head into the first of a couple of holidays, namely Thanksgiving?
I've directed the Oregon State Police to work with local law enforcement to enforce gathering limits, but it's much in the same way as local officers respond to noise complaints for loud parties, for example, and issue citations. I'm not expecting law enforcement to be going door to door, but certainly in cases where there's a flagrant violation, people should and will be cited.
What's the threshold you're looking for in terms of determining whether further restrictions will be needed?
Look, I've said all along, I'm not going to be the party police. This is really up to individuals to take responsibility for their actions. What we know is that informal social gatherings are super spreader events. So I've asked Oregonians to limit their social gatherings, keep it to their own household, and no more than 6 people and no more than 2 households. I know this is really, really hard. We all want to spend Thanksgiving with our families. I have to tell you, we have great family events, friends, family, fabulous food. We play games. But I would rather celebrate in a very small group this Thanksgiving and then have a fabulous festivity next Thanksgiving and see all of my family members live through this pandemic.
There are obviously other issues that are happening here in terms of the COVID-19 impact. And part of that is the economic struggles that many people are facing. There's no coronavirus aid in sight from Congress. How are you planning to help those Oregonians who are struggling right now financially?
When I issued our Stay Home, Save Lives order in March, there were a couple things. Number one, Oregonians didn't have pandemic fatigue. Our businesses were more resilient. And we knew then that Congress would step up and deliver a coronavirus relief package. Here, obviously, we're all tired of the pandemic. So there's that level of fatigue, and our businesses are much less resilient. And Oregon is truly a small business state. Our small businesses are the heart and soul of our economy. They are the lifeblood of who we are as a people. So I am going to be investing $50 million into our coronavirus relief funds into our iconic small businesses to make sure that they can survive. But the other piece is really, really important. We are reaching a cliff, a coronavirus relief fund cliff. Our resources from the federal government run out on December 30th, 2020. We need Congress to act. We need them to put aside their political differences. I don't give a damn if you're Democrat or Republican. We need you to work together in Congress and deliver a second coronavirus relief package to provide aid to the states and local governments, to our tribes that are suffering, to our businesses, large and small, that have borne the brunt of this pandemic.
In addition to that, many communities are hurting. Many people are facing, as eviction moratoriums run out throughout the country, many people are also facing the possibility of losing their residences or their homes. What's the state of evictions so far in Oregon?
So we have a eviction moratorium in place till the end of the year. I am working with the state legislature to come up with a package to address not only the moratorium side, but frankly, you know, we have a lot of small landlords who are hurting financially because their tenants can't pay the rent. We need a package that addresses both needs. I am hopeful that we can put politics aside and do what's right for Oregon. But Congress also needs to step up here. I sent a letter to Speaker Pelosi and Senator McConnell outlining specific needs that we have, and we desperately need $350 million in rental relief. These are not resources that the states have. Every state has this level of need. Unlike the federal government, we can't borrow money. We have to balance our budget. We've stepped up in ways we've never seen before to address the pandemic. We need Congress to take action sooner rather than later.
Portland, Oregon has become the center of, at least over the summer, a lot of the social justice protests that we've seen unfold across the country. It has also, the state of Oregon, become one of the places where militia groups have become increasingly dangerous. What is your response to those militia groups and others who would in some ways be considered domestic terrorists?
Look, I have been very, very clear. Nationalist groups are unwelcome here in Oregon. Their hate and violence is unacceptable. I've worked with elected officials from both sides of the aisle to denounce their work. And frankly, our president should be doing the same. I look forward to welcoming an administration that will denounce white supremacy and white nationalism. This is the United States of America.
Governor, how are you dealing with the people, including other Oregon elected officials, who oppose your restrictions? I mean, what's your response to the pushback?
I am continuing to make decisions based on science and data. I know that there are people who are in denial that this virus is real, but that's unfortunate that they see it that way. I expect our elected officials to hold themselves to a higher standards and make sure that our constituents, wherever they live in Oregon, are getting the information they need to protect their families, and themselves from COVID-19.
Governor Kate Brown of Oregon, thank you so much and best of luck to you.
Thanks, Tanzina. Be safe out there.
And on this show, we talk a lot about empathy. And one way to show that is through random acts of kindness. And those can be especially important in these difficult days. So we asked you, our listeners, how have you experienced kindness in your lives recently? World Kindness Day was, in fact, last week, and since then, we've been getting your stories.
This is Amelia from Arlington, Massachusetts. In honor of World Kindness Day, my son's first grade class celebrated by everybody giving compliments to each other, and they were all super kind and thoughtful, and you would never know that many of them had actually never even met in person because the class is all on Zoom. So that was very sweet and warmed my heart. Happy World Kindness Day, everyone.
This is Sarah from Portland, Oregon. I have a teenage son who's been really severely depressed
since the COVID isolation. And so we started cooking on Sundays for his favorite teacher, because she's a single mother and is also homeschooling her children in addition to teaching full time. And we take food over once a week, and it has really helped him feel better about himself. He feels more sense of purpose and connection with his community. It's really cheered him up a lot.
I just love that we have a National Kindness Day in this country. And I just wish that would be fun for more people. For me, I find doing kindness for others probably the most enjoyable thing in my life right now. I generally bring flowers to new neighbors, anybody who's had a surgery or is feeling sick. It's only like, you know, $7 to $15 at the grocery. And it makes them feel so seen and cared about. And that warms my heart.
I'm Lisa, and this is my kindness story. Yesterday, I had to replace my old tires. And while I was waiting in line at the tire shop, a clean-cut, well-dressed man ahead of me was there to buy new rims and wheels for his brand new SUV. So I went across the street to wait for my tires to be put on, and I had a Zoom call to do. So I sat on the patio of a boarded-up old Burger King. And as I sat on my call, I realized there happened to be an unhomed man living there. He walked by me, and despite his circumstances on this chilly morning, he totally cheerily wished me a good morning. The juxtaposition of these two events hit me, and I actually just cried. I live in Silicon Valley, where these two realities occupy the same space, buying tires or fancy new wheels, and homelessness. So after picking up my car, I went back to that Burger King patio, and I approached the kind man. I regret not asking him his name, but we briefly talked, and I warned him about the COVID cases increasing and to please be careful. He showed me he was prepared as he pulled out a few of his old disposable face masks. And he told me he's trying to take vitamins and just keep from freezing at night. I didn't have much cash on hand, but I gave him what I had, and along with a new bottle of hand sanitizer that I had in my car. He was so happy about the sanitizer that he started using it immediately with this really big smile on his face. I choked up once again, and I apologized for the unfairness of this world and the area where we live. Yet this man stayed so positive, and he just reminded me that it's the holiday season, and he sincerely wished me happy holidays. So I'm not sure which gift made more of an impact yesterday, but personally, I'm pretty sure the kindness he extended to me will supersede the small kindness I gave him for a very long time.
This is Ruth Daines from Palo Alto, California. My single 29-year-old son recently gave some money to a random person he saw on social media. The person who was requesting money was another single male and needed financial help due to coronavirus-related job loss and all that stuff. The recipient was so, so grateful, and I was very moved by the kindness of my son, who has a stable job but is still just starting out himself. When the man thanked him profusely, my son responded with something like, "Hey, I'm happy to help. That's what it's for, man." Interactions like this one involving my son give me hope for a better future for our country.
Keep calling us and telling us your stories of kindness given and received at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's The Takeaway. We're continuing to explore the international reaction to Joe Biden's presidential win. Today, we turn to the African nations of Nigeria and Ethiopia, where conflicts in those countries have escalated and could present challenges for a Biden-Harris administration. Tensions are coming to a head in Ethiopia. Prime Minister Abiy launched a military attack on the Tigray nation of Ethiopia after he accused the Tigray People's Liberation Front of attacking a military base in attempt to steal weapons. The conflict has continued to escalate over the past 2 weeks, and thousands have already fled the region to Sudan. Here to help us understand the context in the conflict is Samuel Getachew, a local journalist in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, with The Reporter. Samuel, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Yinka Adegoke, the Africa editor for Quartz. Yinka, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So, Samuel, let's start with you. Tell us about the tensions that led to the violence between Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy and leaders of the semi-autonomous Tigray region.
Well, it began 2 weeks ago when Ethiopia accused the TPLF government. That has been taken out now because there's a new administration that has been appointed by the Prime Minister. When he accused them, which they later admitted, to attacking a military base in Tigray and killing soldiers. And that's what made them, according to them, attack the region in order to take out the leadership that they've accused of criminal acts, human rights abuses in the past. You know, as you know, the TPLF was in government for the last 27 years before Abiy came to power. They've been having this conflict since a year ago, accused of all kinds of stuff, including holding an election when the House of Federation in Addis Ababa told them not to, and which they won by 100%, reminding many Ethiopians of the election of 2007 when they were in government in Addis Ababa, which they also claimed to have won by 100%. So it's a mixture of all kinds of things that pushed the federal government to act. And that's where we are right now.
Now, Yinka, Prime Minister Abiy was appointed in 2018, and he was seen as a reformer who was releasing political prisoners from jail. But about a year ago, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for forging peace with neighboring Eritrea after decades of conflict. What were the hopes for his administration, and how have things actually played out?
Well, the hopes were he would lead Ethiopia, which is, as you know, Africa's second most populous country, down the road of democracy, because he was seen as this this reformer. And there was a lot of excitement. He gets the Nobel Peace Prize, and governments around the world, leaders around the world, are, you know, sort of patting him on the back, and everyone's excited about it, because Ethiopia has so much potential. It's been the fastest growing country, one of the fastest growing countries in the world, not just in Africa, for over the last decade. But you know, Ethiopia has a very what we can call a sort of a tense federation of different regions of semi-autonomous nations, if you like, and it's been very tricky to hold that together while also sort of dangling this promise of democracy. Instead, it's almost been the reverse. If you speak to Ethiopians now, they feel that there's a lot of displeasure across the different regions, not just in Tigray, even among his own people, the Oromos, Amhara. There are all these concerns where the locals feel they're not being given the freedom and that reach for democracy that seemed very likely at the start.
Samuel, human rights observers are concerned that the conflict that's taking place in Ethiopia will further destabilize the Horn of Africa. What is the logic here in targeting Eritrea?
But, you know, you have to know, I think your listeners need to know that Eritrea was part of Ethiopia at one point, and it was the TPLF government that gave them the right of referendum to have their own nation. But it was after 5 years that the TPLF government was provoked by Eritrea to get into a conflict that killed at least 80,000 people from both sides. Since then, Eritrea has always taken note of Ethiopia's interest or Ethiopia's willingness to fight with them or against them. So for at least 18 years, you know, the Ethiopian government then, the EPRDF government, agreed on Algeria getting involved and trying to have some kind of peace agreement. So once the peace agreement made its own decision, it was the EPRDF government, which is a TPLF government, that decided to disagree with it and walk away. So Eritrea, you know, Ethiopia felt the peace agreement favored Eritrea. Once it was rendered, it was the EPRDF government that walked away. So since then, Isaias Afwerki, the longtime president of Eritrea, has looked down on Ethiopia as an enemy. Not Ethiopia per se, but EPRDF or the TPLF. So 2018, when Abiy came to power and decided to have some kind of peace with Eritrea, the TPLF government was in a disagreement because they felt they weren't part of the engagement. And that might be why the first disagreement with TPLF leadership pushed them to just leave Addis Ababa and go to the state of Tigray, and decided to wage some essence of war with the federal government that they felt was no longer in their interest in Addis Ababa.
Yinka, what does this conflict mean for the larger refugee crisis in Ethiopia?
This is a really troubling time for the Horn of Africa region, which has seen some peace in recent years. But as this conflict, which is like right at the borders of three countries here, you have Ethiopia, obviously, Eritrea, and then Sudan, where, you know, refugees are fleeing after the bombing in Tigray. It could be very problematic, and it could actually not just pull in other countries, it could further destabilize other regions of Ethiopia to the south. So this is what we're watching now, and, you know, there's a lot of concern. The U.S. government, Mike Pompeo, has put out some short statements about the usual sort of thing, being deeply concerned. But you don't get a sense that the current U.S. administration is fully engaged. They put out the usual statements, but you don't get a sense that they are about to go in and really, you know, get involved.
Well, let's talk about that, because there is a new administration that will be taking office in January, at the end of January. And I'm wondering whether or not that administration, the Biden-Harris administration, is giving any hope to better and improved relations with the United States. Samuel?
You know, we've been watching statements coming from, advisors of Biden, Harris. For example, when Trump said Egypt was in a position to also attack the Renaissance Dam of Ethiopia, it was one of his advisors who said, that's not the role of America, because America is in a position to mediate between Sudan, Egypt, and Ethiopia. So they seem to be more in tune with wanting to be engaged. Susan Rice was a former head of the African Affairs at the State Department. She knows Ethiopia very well. And there's also a few Ethiopian Americans helping Biden in terms of his transition to government. So Ethiopians remain hopeful because when Trump was president, he's still president until I guess early next year, he was never engaged with the continent. Beyond the insults he's been throwing at the continent, he's never visited any country since he became president. He's looked down on the continent. To even have him to mediate, let alone help this tension to go down, is it confuses lots of people instead of see America as a beacon of hope, which it has been for a long, long time, despite its shortcomings, despite the fact there are many countries that Americans have their own interest in. But in Ethiopia, they've been involved in developmental aid. America is the biggest funder of Ethiopia's ambitions to become self-sufficient, to have the economy grow. So the funding that was announced in 2012 under Obama is still the funding they're using in Ethiopia right now. But if he did actually became president again, reelected, his legacy would really have had a negative impact. That's beyond whether you agree with aid or not. But again, America, we're hopeful America would be more engaged. I think the world needs America than, China. I'm taking sides, maybe because I grew up in Canada. But, you know, we see America's hope. It gave many of us a chance to be educated. My father was personally educated by the generous support of American government during Jimmy Carter a long time ago. So we look up on America and expect the best, not the worst that we've seen the last 4 years.
Samuel Getachew is a local journalist in Ethiopia with The Reporter. Samuel, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we turn now to Nigeria, where the country has seen massive anti-police brutality protests. And we're continuing our conversation with Yinka Adegoke from Quartz. Yinka, this year we've seen protests in Nigeria, particularly against police brutality with the hashtag #EndSARS. Where do those protests stand right now?
Well, those protests were against police brutality, as you know, and police brutality has been a big problem in Nigeria for many, many years, but really sort of peaked in the last few years with this special police unit, which had harassed young people, especially young men, but also young women, on all kinds of spurious reasons, kidnapping and arrests and allegedly some killings of innocent people. So these protests were well organized with thousands and thousands of people and really had got to the point where the government started to get worried. And then we had the horrible incident of innocent protesters being shot at night at the Lekki toll gate. That is now being investigated. The army denies they were involved. The police say they had nothing to do with it. And it's kind of the usual thing that tends to happen in Nigeria, where no one is accepting blame, but there were plenty of witnesses who saw men in military uniform who were involved in these shootings.
Yinka, what's been the United States response so far to these demonstrations, if any?
It's been very limited. It's been the kind of, as you say, the kind of deeply concerned kind of rhetoric and not too much action. Nigeria has not been at the top of the Trump administration in any kind of positive way throughout the years of this of the Trump administration. So I guess the protesters or whoever, the organizers, could have looked to the United States for the kind of moral support they might have had in previous years, certainly not with this administration.
Wondering if we can expand the lens a little bit to talk about the Trump administration's relationship with Nigeria. We just spoke about Ethiopia and perhaps other African nations. Has the Trump administration been involved really to any extent that's meaningful during the time that he's been in office?
It's funny. In preparation for this, I went back and looked over a few stories, and I was actually surprised at how bad it has actually been with Nigeria specifically. You know, it started off with this kind of patronizing UN meeting where they talked about how some of my friends are getting rich in your countries, and then, you know, then it became about the weapons that the Nigerian government had been trying to get for a long time to take on Boko Haram in the northeast of the country, which the Obama administration had actually been very arguably wisely kind of cautious about selling those weapons to the government because they understood that some of them would be misused. And they did sell them to the military, but along with that came all kinds of misuse and corruption. And protesters being shot in 2018, the Trump administration said nothing. Trump made comments about President Buhari as a lifeless president and not wanting to meet with him again. Remember the whole countries thing. The really important part about that was that it wasn't so much just the foul language insult. It was really the context of him talking about immigration and not wanting, you know, Africans and those people from Nigeria can go back to their huts or whatever it was he was reported to have said. And then the immigration one goes further because they blocked Nigerians from getting green cards. They cut student visas for Africans on the basis of people overstaying their visas, other people overstaying their visas. So they cut the amount of student visas that the Africans, in particular Nigerians, can get. Even just recently, think about Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, the former Nigerian finance minister, you know, trying to run in for the president of the World Trade Organization. And the Trump administration is the only holdout. The European Union, China, everyone else has supported her appointment, but not the Trump administration. So, you know, it's just there's a long list when you actually really look back on it.
There's one other thing. I mean, we talked a little bit about in the previous segment about what hopes for the Biden administration could be. But are there any specific areas that you're expecting the Biden administration should deal with, you know, as they take office, that are pressing top of mind, with the conflict in Nigeria, what's happening in Ethiopia, or other issues that you think are should be top of mind for Biden-Harris?
Yeah, all of these are definitely of importance. I think the big change, really, in many sense, in many ways, there's an argument to say if you take a really, you know, really pull back and take a big picture view, there, the U.S.-Africa policy doesn't change very much, regardless of who's in government, Republicans or Democrats, because there's kind of a long-running U.S.-Africa consensus on Capitol Hill. So in terms of real hardcore policy, things don't change that much. But as you can see from just the list I gave you on one country, you refer to the Ethiopia comments earlier, where Trump said, "Why, you know, Egypt could bomb your dam." It's more kind of a matter of respect to these countries. It has not been there over the last 4 years. And just having a what you might call a more traditional administration, which actually engages with countries and has actual experts. The thing anyone will tell you in DC is this administration has very few Africa experts, and the Biden administration will almost certainly have quite a few. And that just makes quite a huge difference in how you engage with countries, because you're not coming in with your completely, you know, fixed views. You're speaking to people who've lived in these countries, who've worked in these countries as diplomats, and they kind of know how to engage. And sure, they will always put the U.S. interest first, and that's their job and that's their role. But they kind of understand where the pressure points are and how to engage. And that's been the big thing that's been missing, that this administration has. Sure, hasn't changed a huge amount of actual policy, but has certainly changed a lot of attitudes in terms of engaging governments. And frankly, you can already see across Africa with different governments, there's more willingness to reverse some of the sort of democratic progress that's been made over the last couple of decades, because there's a feeling that, well, they're not really paying attention to us, will be my guess.
Yinka Adegoke is the Africa editor for Quartz. Yinka, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show for today, everyone. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Keep calling us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.